So let me remind you what we have done so far, or where we are right now. So right now, we are playing with minimal surfaces in Antidesiter 5. Basically, we understood, or we were led to the conjecture, that somehow computing the area of minimal surfaces is related to computing the expectation value of Wilson loops, where the contour of the Wilson loop indicates the boundary of the minimal surface that lives in Antidesiter. So we have some surface in Antidesiter that approaches some curve C, and we study the minimal surface that ends on this boundary, that is this curve sigma. We can also study the surface that starts at this boundary and just goes up as a cylinder, that's sigma naught. And the claim is that the difference of these two areas is nothing but the expectation value of this supersymmetric Wilson loop, which is a finite object. So this was really the original conjecture by Maldacena in 98 for the expectation value of this supersymmetric Wilson loop chi of t that I wrote there. And the claim is that that relation is true actually at any value of the coupling, in the sense that if you are infinitely powerful and could compute this psi using gauge theory techniques at strong coupling, you would find this result. And similarly, this result is actually the lambda going to infinity limit of a more general expression where you integrate over all string world sheets with a fixed boundary, and the boundary is that it approaches this surface over here. So you have some string path integral with fixed boundary conditions. If lambda is very large, this is dominated by the saddle point solution, which is the solution to the classical equations of motion, which is just the area. But in general, if you are again infinitely powerful, and if you could compute this for any value of lambda, in particular, you should be able to compute it at small lambda and reproduce perturbative computation in Young-Mills. Okay, very good. So this is the conjecture. This is the claim. And just one comment, because yesterday Mohammed pointed out that actually something I said was maybe a bit too fast. Remember that I said that if you compute the area of sigma minus the area of sigma naught, you cancel the divergence. Because this divergence of this Wilson loop, we saw that the physical meaning of it, I can think of it as mass renormalization of my particle that goes along the loop. And it's proportional to the length of the loop times the times 1 over the ultraviolet cutoff. And you see that the way I drew these surfaces, I drew this red surface approaching the boundary in the same way as the cylinder approaches the boundary. It just goes vertically to the boundary. Of course, you could imagine that if the red surface approaches the hadron, say, with zero derivative, going very smoothly and so on, it would, of course, generate a different ultraviolet behavior, and by subtracting both, I would not get a finite result. So why does the red surface approach, why does physically the red surface approach in the same way as the cylinder, why does it go vertically, why does it go like this to the boundary? Let me remind you that this was indeed the case. Remember, for the quark-antiquark potential, for example, for the quark-antiquark potential, when we studied, this is the cut of the surface then stretches there. We studied this minimal surface, right? And we saw that the derivative here, it was really, if you remember, you can check your notes, z prime, as you approach this point, behaves as 1 over z squared. So the derivative is really infinite. It really goes vertically down. So this is a property of this particular solution. I'm claiming that it's a property of all solutions. And this is just because the Poincaré metric has a huge rep factor close to z equals 0. So that it costs a lot of area to spend time at small z. So the surface doesn't want to approach smoothly z equals 0 and spend lots of time there. She wants really to go directly to the boundary as fast and as vertical as possible. Okay, it costs lots of area, a divergent amount of area, to spend time close to z equals 0. Okay? So the area, the surface, just wants to go directly. And you can make this intuition rigorous. You can just say, let me try to solve the equations of motion perturbatively close to the boundary. So you try to write, let x mu, that depends on sigma and tau, let this be sigma and tau be this. Let's parameterize my surfaces where this is sigma and this direction there is tau. Locally, and of course, x mu starts with x mu of sigma. Then there is an expansion in tau, a deviation from this boundary curve. Tau, tau squared, tau cubed, tau 4, and similarly for z. Tau, it starts like this, then tau squared, and so on. And if you do it, you can plug into the equation of motion this expansion, try to solve, and see how many terms are determined by these boundary conditions. And the first thing you see is that the first two coefficients of the expansion is 0, and then you see that the next term of the expansion is totally fixed by the boundary curve that you choose, and the next ones start to be non-local and they start to depend on the global properties of the surface. Okay? So the way it deviates, really, the third derivative away from the origin already knows about the shape of the loop everywhere else. Okay, which is natural. This is a problem that, given a shape, it's not everything local. You need the global shape to know where the surface wants to go. And actually, it turns out, this is irrelevant for the discussion, that the next term has some nice geometrical meaning as the variation of the area with respect to small shifts of the contour. And this is some non-local function that you have to solve some differential equations, the equations of motion, to solve it. So the first few ones are very local, the way it deviates from this. And the main point is that it does deviate exactly like the cylinder. And therefore, by subtracting these two areas, we get the finite result. We will now check it on one more example, that the area has indeed this property. But of course, this is a general proof. We saw that for this supersymmetric Wilson loop, the reason why this was finite was that there are no ultraviolet divergences now for the propagators when the two points approach. So the propagator now is finite as T1 approaches T2, what previously was an ultraviolet divergence. So now let's continue our study of Wilson loops, and let's study the simplest possible contour, which is actually not the quark-antiquark contour, but the circular contour. And yesterday we started by computing the potential at weak coupling, the QED potential, and then we went to strong coupling. Let's do the opposite now. Now that we are in the minimal surface mode, let's start by first computing the minimal surface for the circle, and then let's go to the gauge theory. Okay? So our goal, let's consider the circular Wilson loop. Again, let me make the usual statement that this part I wrote before the lecture start, I will not erase it. So don't spend the lecture trying to catch up with what I'm writing. So copy this part later. So what about the circular Wilson loop? So we want to write a boundary. The surface will end on a circle. And then it will stretch here. So let this be, let's parameterize the coordinates. So we want to find some solution. x1 equal to, say, some cosine of theta times r. x2 to be r sine of theta. And z, this height here, is a function of r only. Let's call it z of r, or f of r. Okay? So we parameterize our surface by theta and r. And then at each theta and r, we have some height f of r. Now, what do you do to find this minimal surface that ends on a circle? So this is our parameterization. So let this guy be, say, sigma, and this be our tau. Now, what do we do? Yes?
Find the induced method.
So we plug it again in the Nambu-Goto action, right? So remember, so we have the action for Nambu-Goto. Should I write it? It's exactly the same we wrote last time. Do you want me to write it, or there's no point? So you have an integral d theta from 0 to 2 pi, integral dr from 0 to the radius of the circle. And then remember you had 1 over z square, which is 1 over f of r square, times square root of the determinant. Okay, so check your notes. What was the determinant? Here derivatives with respect to tau, here derivatives with respect to sigma, and here mixed. So now this is tau and sigma. So I don't want to lose time doing this. You just plug these coordinates right into this section. And you find that f of r, the f of r that you want to do, that solves the equations of motion, is equal to the simplest possible function, square root of r squared minus r squared. Okay? So, I mean, really there is nothing conceptually new compared to what we did yesterday. It's actually a much simpler problem because here the equations of motion turn out to be very simple to solve, or very simple to at least to check that this is a solution. So this is our f of r that obeys, that minimizes the action. Okay? Is it clear? We just plug there, exactly like we did yesterday. We find just an action for f of r. We minimize, write equations of motion, and so on. This is what we get. Then, so this is point one. Point two, we compute. By the way, another reason why I'm not doing it is because this is exactly the subject of today's tutorial. Then we compute the area of sigma minus the area of sigma naught. Okay? By the way, just one comment. Notice that here the derivative of f of r with respect to r when small r is equal to capital R, which is the radius of the circle, is diverging. Right? Exactly the same thing as we saw there. As we approach the boundary, it approaches, it's a semicircle law, right? So it's really approaching it as it should. Right? Where this is R. There is, of course. We compute this area, and then we predict the Wilson loop. So the claim is that the conjecture, let's write here the conjecture or the claim. If you do this computation, you find that this difference is equal to this area minus this area is equal to minus 2 pi. So you see these areas are positive, but this one is bigger. So the difference of these two areas is minus 2 pi. So you plug it up there, and the conjecture is that the Wilson loop for the circle behaves when lambda is much bigger than 1 as exponential of minus square root lambda over 2 pi times minus 2 pi of plus just with coefficient 1 square root of lambda. Okay? It's a nice conjecture from ADS CFT. By the way, let me just mention, since we did a circle, there is another way that does not require using equations of motion, somehow more powerful even, that we could use to arrive at this result. So for that we could consider another even simpler contour, which is just the infinite straight line. So for the straight line, the contour is just an infinite straight line that goes like this. That's the contour. What is the minimum surface that ends on this contour? It starts on this contour and goes up. Well, by symmetry, it can only be an infinite plane going up. So this is the solution, and indeed you can check it. It is indeed the minimum surface. Right? So this is our sigma. But of course, this is also equal to sigma naught. Right? So the claim is that the Wilson loop for the straight line is equal to 1 when lambda goes to infinity. And actually it's true that this straight Wilson loop, just by supersymmetry, it's 1 exactly. It's if you want the first check of that this is working. But this is something that we know at strong coupling from this ADS CFT. And why is this related to the circle? Because by a conformal transformation, you can map a line to a circle, right? You know this. If you have the origin, put a line. This is, let this be the origin, let this be a line. If you do x to 1 over x, infinity goes to the origin and you draw a circle. So by a special conformal transformation, you can map a line to a circle, a beautiful circle centered at the origin and so on. But you remember that special conformal transformations add a generalization to isometries of ADS, to transformations that act not only on x but also on z. Yes? So what you can do is you can take this solution, apply that isometry that maps the line into the circle, and it will map the full solution into something. Find what it is, and you find this solution. And you did not need to solve any equations of motion. Okay? So this is another way. So now we can do a conformal transformation and get from the line to the circle. And by conformal transformation, I mean this generalized isometry that I showed you the other day. Okay, very good. Let's go to the gauge theory now, unless there are questions.
One question.
Yes?
In the second step, you will calculate the area zero. So the height here is extended to infinity, right?
Which one? Here?
Yeah.
Here? Yes. So I said that sigma is equal to sigma naught.
No, I mean in general, it's the height extends to infinity, even in the...
Yes, the height extends to infinity. Notice that the area is perfectly finite. There is 1 over z squared here. So the integral of 1 over z squared when z goes to infinity is perfectly convergent. So this area, sigma, that goes from here to infinity, it's divergent because of this epsilon that we always need to regulate each of them. And then epsilon drops out. But it's perfectly fine when you integrate up. Okay? And also, yeah. So up, and remember, by the way, that up was where the brains were. It's not a mystery. So there's no divergence integrating up. The divergences are always close to the boundary. So the boundary is where really you have divergences because the area becomes really enhanced by this 1 over z squared. On the contrary, when z is very large, the area becomes suppressed by the same z squared factor. Okay. So now we move to gauge theory. And we want to study the circular Wilson loop. Okay? So what is this object? It's this path order exponential. So let me remind you of our definition of the path order exponential. It's the expectation value of trace of this exponential that we can expand and write 1 plus integral, say, from 0 to 2 pi dt1 chi of t1. This is just the leading order term, plus an integral from 0 to 2 pi dt1, integral from 0 to t1 dt2, and then chi of t1, chi of t2, plus dot dot dot. Right? This was just our definition of our object. So the first thing we need is, of course, the propagator. And the propagator is what we computed here. Okay? So let's see what the propagator is when we consider this circle. So let's parameterize this circle. Let this be t. So this point, x mu, is equal to r cosine t, r sine t, 0, 0. Okay? So, x dot mu is equal to, if we still know how to do this, minus r sine of t, r cosine of t, 0, 0. Okay? Is it clear? Now, and actually the propagator, sorry, I did something. Yeah, if done more correctly, the propagator, remember, there is coupling in the action. So when you compute the propagator, actually, there is a 1 over coupling, there is a power of coupling, as we know. Remember from this matrix model, we always consider this normalization that propagators come with power of coupling and vertices with 1 over coupling. So now, do you want me to plug this x dot here and do it slowly, or can I just tell you what the result is if I just plug this x here? What should I do?
The result.
The result. So this propagator then chi of t1 chi of t2 is equal to lambda over 16 pi squared. Now there's something very, very remarkable about this result. Can you tell me why? Why this is very weird, or very strange, or very surprising?
Doesn't depend on t1.
Doesn't depend on t1 or t2. So the propagator is a constant. It's independent of x of t1 and x of t2. So it's the same if I have the propagator. Let's remember use this notation for this superfield where I draw something. This propagator is equal to this propagator. Totally independent of where we put them. Very particular for the circle. Sorry?
Yeah. Are you using Euclidean signature or?
Yes. We are always using Euclidean signature when we cut the computer. So it's the total. It's independent. It deserves an exclamation mark. It's quite remarkable. Okay, then the one loop computation is not so hard to do. So at one loop, let's do this at one loop to leading order. So this is equal to 1 from the 1 plus the propagator lambda over 16 pi squared. Now, this propagator is a constant. So let me just extend this integral to the full plane and put a 1/2. 1/2, because since the propagator is a constant, we can extend to full t1 and t2. There's no point. I mean, it's constant, so it just gives me a factor of 1/2 times the integral of t1 gives 2 pi times the integral of t2 gives 2 pi. Right? Totally trivial. Propagator. From extending the integration, this is the 1 over 2 factorial that would normally come from expanding an exponential. 2 pi, 2 pi. So this is equal to 1 plus, can I still do this? So 32, it's not the best way, right? 2 cancels with 2 and then 8. Lambda over 8. And then there are corrections which are of order lambda squared. Okay. Yes? So
this propagator doesn't depend on the radius of the circle. Is this because of the, we have like some
it's because we have scale invariance. Okay. So indeed it should not depend on the radius of the circle. And we see that it does not. I mean, here it's quite obvious that it does not, right? Because all this x and x dot is proportional to r, and we have two x's upstairs and two x's downstairs. So it's clear that it could not depend on the overall scale. That's just scale invariant. So okay, we see that we start, if this conjecture is true, we start, if we take the logarithm of the Wilson loop as function of lambda, the claim is that at strong coupling we have a square root. So we have square root of lambda here. And here we have lambda over 8. And here we don't know. Okay, cool. Let's continue. And let's consider, what do we do after one loop? Two loops. Right? Good. Two loops. What diagrams do we have to draw at two loops? So instead of this, what do we have to do? Well, there are two classes of diagrams. One is, for example, can have a propagator and then another propagator. By the way, important, there is no diagram like this where you have propagator and then another propagator. Why? We are not considering such diagrams. Why? Because it's non-planar, right? Lines cannot cross. We only draw the lines that don't cross. So this is, by the way, important. There are not, because of planarity. We want leading order in 1 over n. So this guy would be 1 over n squared suppressed. As now you know very well. So this one we could draw. What else? This one we could also draw. But now there are more. So by this I mean this. By this I mean this superpropagator. Okay? Whereas by this I will denote the gluon. And by this, the scalar. But then there are other graphs. Other graphs, so that, for example, I can have a gluon, and a gluon. Or a scalar and a gluon. From the 10-dimensional point of view, these are the same. Or a gluon that exchanges, that has some loop, plus dot, dot, dot. Now, these diagrams, there are clearly two groups of diagrams. These guys are diagrams with vertices in the bulk. Right? These are diagrams that contain vertices in the middle of the loop. Whereas these ones here are what one calls butterflies or rainbows. These are just rainbow diagrams which contain no bulk vertices. Both are important. Okay? Yes?
What is the difference between two?
What two? The first two? So you see that you have four fields, T1, T2, T3, T4 that are ordered. Yes. Once you write this expansion here.
Yes.
Right?
And they go one pair and then another pair.
Right. So when you compute this, after taking the trace, you are right that you get cyclicity. But in the way you compute, you choose a starting point to compute. So really, suppose... So okay, so Ivan's question is, why is this diagram... Why am I not overcounting? After all, if I move this line here, this looks like the same as there. But actually, the way you compute, you should keep in mind that... You choose some origin, 0. Then at the end, nothing depends on it. But there is some origin here. So what term contributes to those diagrams? These diagrams here, they come from a diagram here in this, from a term in this dot, 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 which is what? Integral dt1, dt2, dt3, dt4, and then the chi's. Right? Now, forget about diagrams and suppose you are doing just weak contractions. Right? What are diagrams? Diagrams are mnemonics for the weak contractions. So then you have two possible weak contractions. You have this one and this one, or this one and this one. Right? And I mean, you really need to sum these two contributions, right? You agree? If you forget diagrams. So now I need a diagram to represent the first contraction and a diagram to represent the second contraction. Right? And those are these two diagrams here. Right, so this would be A and this would be B. So this lower part, this contractions here would be A, this contractions here would be B. Is it clear for everyone? So in practice, one can think that this it's always a bit open when we compute. And there's always like an origin. And we can remember that this is like T equals 0, and then it's T equal 2 pi. So if you want to have a one-to-one map between diagrams and what comes from weak contractions, it's better to open them a bit and then you can you no longer have the right of relating the two diagrams that you wanted to do. Was this clear? Yeah? Yes?
And about the fermions in the propagators, you don't consider them anymore.
Here? You also have fermions here.
Okay, you don't have fermions. I mean, because now we are seeing scalars and the dual, but...
Yeah, this could be a loop of fermions. Okay. No problem. The fermions cannot leave from the loop, of course, because they don't couple to the loop, but in the middle, they can be there. So the fermions are here. So there are, let me draw a term for ether. There is, for example, something like this. This is a fermion. Now it has an arrow, and then something like this. Okay? Fermions are there. Now, all this bracket is the painful one, but it was computed, they computed these diagrams in 2001. It was computed by Erickson, Semenov, and Zarembo. And after summing on all these painful interactions, all these self-energies and these vertices and so on, they find a very simple result for these diagrams with vertices in the bulk. So for these diagrams with interactions in the bulk. And the very simple result is zero. They found that they cancel out. So you compute these two loop diagrams, and you find that they are zero. Of course, this is two loops. Okay? So this is an experimental observation. You did the experiment, which is you spend some months computing these diagrams, and you find that they give zero. And for them, it's probably 1 week or something, but it's still some work, and you find that they give zero. Very good.
And physically, why is that?
What's the modern understanding of this, you are asking?
Yeah.
Do we understand what is happening? So for now, let me keep this historical perspective. And in the second half of the lecture, I will comment the recent developments. And one of them will be the explanation of this fact. But for now, let's continue exploring, imagining we ourselves are doing this computation and trying to see how far we could go. Now, if someone will tell you that there is this remarkable miracle that the bulk diagrams will contribute, what would be a fun conjecture to make if you would like, say, to make progress? What could you try to conjecture? Sorry? Very good. So Ivan's conjecture is that all, so conjecture, right, is that could it be that all bulk diagrams cancel? After all, it's sort of trivial that all of these cancel. Let's conjecture this to be the case. So what this conjecture is telling, so, is that the expectation value, this is motivated by experiment if you want, is 1 plus just this loop, plus then at two loops we have these two diagrams, plus at three loops we would have this diagram, plus, let me see, how many do I want to draw? Plus this diagram, plus, okay? So this would be the consequence of the conjecture. So this is equivalent to the conjecture. Okay? But now, so first of all, is someone unhappy with this statement or is everyone following this? Is it okay? This is the logical consequence of this conjecture. Now, what is each of these propagators? It's a constant, right? Do you agree? So each propagator is a constant. So basically what this is the following, is the expectation value of 1 plus chi chi with 1 half plus 1 over 4 factorial k chi, 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 plus tak, 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 in a Gaussian matrix model. Because the fact that these points are at different positions of space-time is absolutely irrelevant. As Grisha pointed out, these two points, I mean, all these points on the outside should be roughly the same point in space-time from this point of view. This propagator doesn't know, doesn't treat this point and this point in a separated way. This is just a constant, so I can think that space-time is really zero-dimensional. And here, from this point of view, I just get a constant for each of these propagators. So I don't lose anything if, on the one hand, I drop all the interactions, and on the other hand, I replace my model by just a Gaussian matrix model. Yes?
What about the number of different diagrams?
The number of different diagrams is automatically taken into account by the weak contractions in the matrix model. Because those weak contractions are exactly the same that you do here. You have four chi's, and here is it, two diagrams here. How many diagrams in the matrix model? Two. So of course the counting is exactly the same. The propagators is also the same, so nothing changes. Do you agree? And if I'm careful, you see, from each integration there are powers of 2 pi, so maybe there is some 2 pi squared here, some 2 pi to the 4 here, and so on. But this is nothing but the expectation value of the exponential of 2 pi chi in a Gaussian matrix model, because the odd ones don't contribute.
So what happened to the trace?
Yeah, there is a trace. So this is nothing but the expectation value of the trace of e to the matrix in a Gaussian matrix model. Have we seen this before? Yes, this was what we solved in the second lecture. Right? We computed exactly this, expectation value of a Gaussian. This was our toy model for learning to deal with large n limits. So if you do it carefully, keeping track of all factors of pi, here is the result. 2 over square root of lambda, Bessel function, remember, of square root of lambda. Now, did someone, the wiki was not down yesterday. Did someone go to the wiki and did someone do what I asked to do? Yes? Did someone do so? What I asked you to do is to remind you of this function and study how it behaves at small and large lambda. Did someone do that? Can someone tell me how this guy looks like when lambda is very large? Without using Mathematica? No one saw? If you compute this, when lambda goes to infinity, and there will be a couple of exclamation marks here, we find exactly exponential of square root of lambda. Exactly what we should find. Extremely strong evidence for our conjecture. So it means that we have our first plot. The Wilson loop, or let's say the log of the Wilson loop, is just the log of this Bessel function, and it behaves, it starts as lambda over 8, it goes to square root of lambda over 8, I don't know the precise shape, but this is the function at any value of the couple in a gauge theory. This is a highly remarkable result. If this conjecture is true, if our conjecture is true, it's based on some remarkable cancellations, we have a first interpolation in a four-dimensional gauge theory between weak and strong coupling. It was computed, you see, purely using gauge theory. Purely using gauge theory. When did we use ADS-CFT? Just to feel a bit more confident. Just because it was great that we ended up exactly where ADS-CFT predicted. But strictly speaking, we did not use them. I mean, it was really purely within gauge theory. So this is one of those examples where ADS-CFT is used as an inspiration, as a guiding principle. If it would fail, it would not mean it would be wrong. But we should reconsider and think carefully, did we do a mistake or something like that. But it was really a pure computation, just a conjecture and a computation purely based on gauge theory considerations. Okay? Was this part fast? So again, the logic was both diagrams don't contribute. Diagrams which are not bubbles are exactly like a matrix model because propagators are constant for the circle. And therefore, I can replace all these propagators by just averages in a Gaussian matrix model. This average is exactly an exponential of a matrix in the Gaussian matrix model. And this was exactly the example we solved that gives a Bessel function. Very good. So now we know.
Is it possible to get this result function by conformal transformation?
Sorry?
Is it possible to get this result function by a conformal transformation somehow?
Some people claim yes, but I never managed to completely master that argument. Yeah. So there is a nice story about showing that if you do a conformal transformation from the straight line where you find the result which is zero, so for the straight line, you can again draw the diagrams that go from the straight line and have vertices in the bulk. And again, they cancel perfectly. But now the ladders are strictly zero because the ladder, you see, the way it couples, if you have a straight line, x dot dot x dot is the same as x dot times x dot if the line is straight. Right? So the propagator between two points in a straight line is identically zero. So if the diagrams in the bulk also cancel, and they do, then the claim is that the Wilson loop should be 0, should be 1 to all loop orders. But now you ask, okay, but you have 1 on the one hand, you have this Bessel function on the other hand, and you have a conformal transformation that relates them. Can I somehow understand this Bessel function as a conformal transformation of 1? It's a bit hard. There are some more or less hand-waving arguments that it could be done by showing that what happens is that there is an anomaly with this conformal transformation that happens at infinity. This is the argument of Gross, Drucker, and Noguri. And because the anomaly is at infinity, it's just like one point of space-time, so then you should have a matrix model living at infinity, blah, 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 and you end up with this. And I recommend that you can read the paper if you want more details on it. But right now, we know better how to understand this remarkable result. So let me comment now on the remaining part of today's lecture on some recent developments so that we can close this chapter on Wilson loops and tomorrow move to local observables in gauge theory, which are equally interesting if not more. Okay, so what do I have listed here? So at the first one I will not write because I already discussed the other day was okay, I can write. So what about the usual Wilson loop? The usual bosonic Wilson loops. What is their dual? How do I compute them? Is there progress in understanding ADS-CFT? Not only for this supersymmetric where this worked perfectly, but also what about usual Wilson loops? And the prescription was, for example, just given by Aldai and Maldacena in 2007 by a very indirect argument, by really approximating, by saying that you can approximate this. Okay, no, sorry, forget about it. Just by a very indirect argument. So you see, it's a very recent development. Remember that, as I said, this Wilson loops, this first conjecture that we wrote here, was proposed 1 year after ADS-CFT. Maldacena proposed it in 98. You see, it took 10 years to get to the usual Wilson loops. Now, another important question that we must ask is, why did this work? And of course, I'm speaking about the circle. Why did it work? How come in like 10 minutes we got an all loop result in a gauge theory? I mean, this is suspicious. What is behind this? For example, we could ask, can we do the same for the quark antiquark potential? Can we just take the quark antiquark and some say over all letters, for example, like this, and some over all these letters, that is the analog of those rainbows, and do we get the good result? That, for example, when lambda goes to infinity, behaves as exponential of square root lambda. Tac, 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 you remember this gamma to the 1/4 to the power 4 that we had found. And the answer for this question is no. Of course not. It's not true that in general you can just, life is not that good. You cannot just drop vertices, start computing ladders, and get quark anti-quark potential and so on. It's more complicated. In this case, actually, this breaks down. Actually, it turns out that this is good for one loop, of course, because one loop, there's only one exchange, and that's what we saw the other day, and two loops. But it breaks down afterwards. So for one and two loops, it's okay. Ladders are the only thing that contributes. The other diagrams cancel. And actually, the purpose of the homework that I'm preparing for you is to study exactly these ladder diagrams at two loops for the quark anti-quark potential. So one thing that you could say is, okay, it fails, but suppose I do it still. Suppose I decide to sum all ladders and to see, what do I get? Do I get a result which is exponential of square root lambda? Yes. So what happens is that when lambda goes to infinity, I get exponential of square root lambda times something, but this turns out to be the wrong number. It is not this nice gamma to the 1/4. So it does exhibit this exponentiation. It does look like something that could come from the area of a string, exponential of square root lambda times something, but no, it is not the correct area of the string. But still, this is something one could play. But then, okay, back to the original question. So why did it work? So it doesn't work always. So why did it work? And the answer to this question came in 2007 by Peston and goes by the name of localization. Okay? And I'm not the expert. I mean, Satoshi can probably tell you much more about this if you want in the break, or you can ask also Jaume and Simone. But localization, what's the basic idea? The basic idea is that it turns out that you can show that the path integral for the circle, for some observables, the path integral, which is something very complicated over the gauge fields, the scalars, the fermions, of some observable times the action, sometimes this localizes and it becomes just an integral over some zero modes or over some solutions to some minima equation. For example, what happens in this time for the circle is that it becomes only an integral over d phi 1, where what is phi 1? Remember, phi 1 was one of the scalars that appears in the Wilson loop. Okay? And notice that I did not write x dependence. It is just the constant value of phi 1. So it's like you imagine decomposing all fields into modes. Then all modes don't contribute. Only the zero mode of one of the scalar contributes. Okay? So this is what Peston showed. Is that only the constant zero mode of one of the scalars contributes. Okay? So let's buy this for now, and let me just give you a flavor of why this matrix model then comes about. Because look what happens now. If this is true, so now this you have to believe, but let's see what follows. Then, the expectation value of the Wilson loop becomes what? Becomes the integral d phi 1. Now, you only have phi 1. So let's see, what is the Wilson loop then? Well, phi 1 is a constant. So I just get exponential of phi 1. So this came from the Wilson loop, or trace of exponential of phi 1. If phi 1 is a constant, I can just take it out, do the integral, and I get just e to the phi 1 times omega. Okay? Is it clear? Just from that exponential there, the path order exponential, phi 1 is a constant, I take it out, I get just maybe times some 2 pi.
What happens with the gauge fields?
The gauge fields, they are zero. Okay. Everyone is set to zero, only the constant part of the scalar is left. That's what he showed. That the integral localizes and this is what remains. What else remains? What about the action? So this is one thing, and then there is the action. E to the minus what comes from the action. Now, kinetic term disappears because phi is constant. Commutator of the scalars disappears because phi is constant. So the commutator also disappears. So nothing remains. This is not an expectation value of a matrix model. Where is the phi square that gives the Gaussian matrix model? Right? Okay, but this is really a hardcore paper, and actually things are a bit more complicated. Because you want to, you cannot just study the theory on R4. To make it really mathematically more defined, you have to add the point at infinity, which makes it an S4. And then it's better to just consider n equals 4 on S4, which is a wild transwild equivalent to R4. So what you have to do this, is go from R4 to apply this localization, and so that there is no subtleties, you go from R4 to the sphere. Now, when you go to the sphere, you know that scalars acquire a coupling, which is Ricci scalar times phi square. And now the curvature of the sphere is constant, and then because of this curvature to S4, the curvature to S4 induces a phi 1 term, kinetic term. This would be phi 1 phi square times the Ricci scalar, which is 1. And this is where the matrix model. So the challenge is to show rigorously that if you do it carefully, putting the theory on S4 and drawing a circle and so on, that the integral localizes. Once you know that it localizes, then the matrix model appears very natural. This is a very interesting and very hot field of research nowadays, to try to understand what class of quantities can be computed by localization, how powerful localization is. It's a quantity that depends extremely strongly on supersymmetry. And as I said, if you want to learn more, maybe this 2007 paper is a good point to start. There are also some nice reviews by Caso, right? Some nice review notes by Caso. Very good. So this is one interesting line of research. Now you might ask, what about, are there other contours that we can use and that we can deal with using localization? And indeed, localization can also be used for the straight line, where the Wilson loop is just one. And it can actually also be used, not for the circle, but for small fluctuations around the circle, or small fluctuations around the straight line. And I think actually Aether and friends, and also the same people I told yesterday, Amit and friends plus Johannes, had a couple of papers on exactly using localization to compute this Wilson loop here. So this is what is called the wavy circle. So the first fluctuation, a small excitation around the circle. So these are two examples where localization can provide an exact answer for these quantities at all loops. And this one, it turns out to be actually quite a nice physical observable, in the same way as the quark-antiquark had this very physical very physical taste, as the force between two particles. This one turns out to be related to the radiation of a particle, the radiation emitted by a particle which accelerates. Okay. But what about then the quark-antiquark? What about our favorite quark-antiquark, our rectangle? That was so cool. So there was some potential V of R, which was minus alpha of lambda over R, where this alpha of lambda goes from lambda over 4 pi for lambda very small and goes to the square root lambda over gamma to the 1/4 to the 4 times some pi's when lambda is very large. What about this guy? So this one, as I said, it was computed like 2 weeks ago. And for this one, some other technique, which is not localization, but integrability, was needed. And actually in this paper, they showed that also the results from localization can be obtained from integrability, but not vice versa. So from this point of view, integrability appears really as the most powerful one in this particular business. From integrability, you could, if you want, reproduce the results that you obtain from localization, but from localization, you don't reproduce all the results that you do with integrability. So integrability is something that we will cover next week. So in particular, by the end of next week, I might give you a flavor of how to go about doing this computation if I decide, I didn't decide yet what I will do. But this will be the this will be something that we will see in detail that will appear a lot when computing these local observables in gauge theory. I think I will not go much over time, finally. Am I going too fast today? I'm doing better than usual with pages. Okay, very good. So there is another interesting line of research now, which concerns what you probably heard already, which is called no polygon Wilson loops. So these are another very, very interesting class of polygons. So remember that Wilson loops, they have divergences, the usual Wilson loops, they have divergences because close to these points, we get x dot square over the ultraviolet cutoff square at the integrand level. So you see that this would be fine, there would be no divergence. There is no divergence if x dot square is equal to 0, if the curve is null. And actually, if you think a bit, let me do this that I said already by words. In 10 dimensions, doing this means what? Means considering a contour, x dot m a m, which becomes integral of x mu dot a mu plus y dot I phi I, once you dimensionally reduce. And null contour means x dot square plus y dot square equal to 0, right? Which is exactly what you achieve if you consider, let's replace x dot by I x dot, y dot, let's replace it by mu, yi, let's replace it by theta I times absolute value of x dot with theta I square equal 1. Then with this parameterization, this solves this constraint. Right? And this is exactly, this is our supersymmetric Wilson loop. It's exactly a loop that in this 10-dimensional sense is locally null. But let's try to do something that is more bosonic, that is null in 4 dimensions. So let's consider a line that is null. Okay? Then what you can do is you can consider a polygon made of these null lines. You can consider a polygon made of concatenating these null lines. Okay? So this is a polygon where each edge, let me call it k, so let this be k1, let this be k2, and all these edges are null. So these are what are called null polygon Wilson loops. Okay? It's one possible class of contours that you might imagine studying. They don't have these ultraviolet divergences. Of course, they do have divergences, but I don't want to discuss them, close to the cusps. But for now, these are another interesting class of contours that you might consider. But now, see, these Wilson loops, they are functions of a set of k's, k1, k2, tac, 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 which are null vectors. Okay? So what functions do you know that likes to take null vectors and give you an amplitude or a number? Someone that did not hear this before in talks or in papers or something. What other function in field theory do we normally do that we take a bunch of k squares, which are, all of them are zero, and we produce a number out of it? A scattering amplitude, right? So it's exactly the same data, or not exactly, and that's one of the recent developments. So it's the same data as a scattering amplitude. Okay, so it's the same data. But actually, not only it's the same data, and here is something extremely remarkable, is that in n equals 4 super young mills in the planar limit, as usual, this is exactly equal to a scattering amplitude, where the particles that you scatter, they have momenta k1, k2, k3, and so on. Exactly equal. Why is this polygon closed? Because you have conservation of momentum. Right? So closed polygon from the amplitude point of view is nothing but conservation of momentum. Makes sense. Nullness of the edges comes from scattering on shell particles, where k square is equal to zero. So this was a conjecture that is now proven, at least for some taste, by Aldheim and Maldacena again in 2007. And this was another remarkable example of using ADS-CFT as inspiration. What they did was they started studying these surfaces. They went to strong coupling. And they asked, what do we need to compute to study a scattering amplitude at strong coupling? What is the minimal surface that we have to compute? And the minimal surface that you have to compute to study a scattering of particles is, of course, something that looks like this, right? We have some particles and we have some minimal surface like this. Can you understand what I'm drawing? Is this minimally clear or not really? See? So, do you understand the picture? Yeah. Yeah? So it's a surface that ends on it. This is a surface representing an amplitude. But then, this is the area that you need to compute. But then they showed that by a transformation known that you heard about in your course, which is called T-duality, they performed a bunch of T-dualities, which is a symmetry, if you want, of antecedent, that maps antecedent to itself. And they obtained another surface that, because it's related by this symmetry, should have the same area. And what is the surface that you obtain? Is a surface which is a surface of a polygon where the edges are k, are the k's of the particles that you scatter. Okay? This is purely at strong coupling. Then you derive that at strong coupling, computing an amplitude is the same as computing this. But this is the prescription for computing a Wilson loop. We are tired of knowing this. So we conclude that at strong coupling, indeed, the amplitude is just equal to the polygon Wilson loop. And then they said, Let's conjecture. This is a true relation at any coupling. And then people, I mean, that otherwise would not have guessed this conjecture, I think, they went to a coupler, and two groups independently performed a very powerful computation and computed these amplitudes. At one loop, it turns out to be true, but one loop is a bit too trivial. But then there was a very important computation that computed this amplitude exactly for this case here with six particles at two loops. Two independent groups, one by Byrne and company, the other by Koshemsky and company. So like two big groups of six people each, they computed this at two loops. They did it numerically because it's too hard to do analytically. So at the end, they had some plots. They compared the two plots or the two numbers and they match exactly at weak coupling at two loops. So big surprise, I mean, very important development. And this then, at that moment, everyone believed that this ought to be a conjecture that should be true for all loops and for all amplitudes and so on. Okay? So this was checked, was proposed at Strom-Kaplan, and later was checked, 1 year later, I think, at weak coupling at two loops. And now there are more checks of higher loops and so on, but this was the very important step that led to the conjecture. So again, you see that once you check it at weak coupling, now, okay, again, you can forget about ADS-CFT, and now you can say, oh, look, one loop they match, two loop they match, they should match always, and so on. But it was very important to have ADS-CFT to give you some intuition and to help you and to guide you, to steer you in the right direction. You see? This is another example where ADS-CFT was extremely important in this quest for solving gauge theories. Now, okay, but actually, the front one I cannot move, right? Okay. Right. Now, don't you want to complain about the possibility of having an equal sign between amplitudes and Wilson loop? Because I was always insisting about an important point. I was always emphasizing. A Wilson loop just depends on the contour. It's parameterization invariant. All it cares is the shape of the polygon. Does an amplitude just care about the momentum of the particles I'm scattering? No. It cares also about polarization of particles. In n equals 4, it cares, am I scattering gluons or scalars or fermions? What am I scattering? What's the polarization? So where is the information about polarizations? Okay. But what about polarization? What about specifying what really do I scatter? And indeed, the original correspondence was a correspondence between bosonic Wilson loops and the simplest possible amplitudes. You might have heard, at least those of you that were discussing with Freddy, called MHV amplitudes, which are the simplest possible scattering amplitudes. Okay? So they are so-called maximally ellicity violating amplitudes. So they have very particular ellicity content. But what about general amplitudes? Somehow, we need to generalize the left-hand side. We need clearly a generalized Wilson loop that also depends on more stuff. So this Wilson loop, as you see, this stuff takes time, was proposed by Dave Skinner, who is a postdoc here, and Mason in 2011, and more or less at the same time by Caron Wood, a postdoc at the Institute, in 2011 as well. Very recent development, as you see, just from last year. Simon Caron's paper is from October of last year, for example. Now that we have this supersymmetric Wilson loops, more progress has been made. And there's lots of progress in this direction of studying these Wilson loops and this amplitude, say, at weak coupling, perturbatively. For example, Freddy and friends recently computed part of this amplitude to all loop order. What part? Let's go to the Wilson loop. Remember in the Wilson loop, when we do any computation at loops, we have the integrand, right? What we integrate, and then we have to do the integrals, say integrals of the over the endpoints of the gluons, but also integrals over the vertices and so on. What they managed to compute was what is the integrand, what do you need to integrate at any loop order. So for example, very important developments in this direction, which were exploring strongly the symmetries that this duality relies on, were for example this all loop integrand of Faraday and friends that allows for to know what you need to integrate at all loop order. Of course, it's still a very hard business to do the integrals, but this is another very important recent development. Well, I told you, actually by luck, I drew exactly the correct picture, that what Alda and Maldacena did was they started with an amplitude of scattering for gluons, and they mapped it into an amplitude for scattering to a polygon with four edges. But then you can ask, what about at strong coupling? What about polygons that end on more edges, corresponding to generic scattering amplitudes with many particles? What is the area of these guys? So since 2007, actually, Fernando Aldai and Juan Malzina, they were really trying actively to find the area of these surfaces. And there was some progress. They managed to find a very particular octagon. They managed to find the result for the hexagon. But for example, this was something that in 2010, together with Amit, Fernando, and Juan, and me, we solved, and this is known, and the result is given. So this is again another recent development in 2010. It's given by a thermodynamic Bittan-Zatz. And you probably heard these words Bittan-Zatz. You know that this is very much related to integrability. And basically the integrability that we explored was the integrability of the string sigma model, of the string model. The fact that the string equations of motion are integrable and that it's possible to explore this integrability to compute this area.
Question?
Yes.
So were you saying that there's four edges Wilson loop, did it match with glowing scattering?
For example, the four particle at strong coupling you compute, and actually the amplitude for four gluons, you can compute it at all orders in perturbation theory also, and it matches exactly with strong coupling.
Why did it select the scattering of the gluons?
With four, it's a simple solution where you have more symmetry that you can explore. If you have more edges, it becomes much harder to find a solution, right?
I mean, like in equal four, we have also scalars. Why didn't it match with the scalars, not the gluons?
Yes, so when I say gluons, I mean gluons or the amplitudes that are related to supersymmetry by those. I mean immediately the supersymmetric family. So whenever we speak about some observable in a supersymmetric theory, the amplitude for that observable or the observables related to that one by supersymmetry is indistinguishable. It's the same amplitude. That's the existence of supersymmetry. But you can imagine, you see, man, we managed to solve the circle and two straight lines. Now this is quite a conceptual jump if I tell you. Now find a surface which ends on an arbitrary polygon. It's a bit more complicated than a circle or two straight lines, as you can imagine, right? And indeed, we managed to find the area of this surface, but we never computed the shape of the surface. That we did not know. Okay? That is what Hendrik is going to do in his project. So he will tell us what the shape of these surfaces look like. This is an important problem if, for example, we want to start studying quantum fluctuations around this surface and start studying these amplitudes at strong coupling. What about Wilson loops then? Here is the strong coupling story, the weak coupling story. As I said, there is this duality, there is this integrand. What about trying to use integrability for studying these Wilson loops also at any value of the coupling? This is of course what I am very interested in, and there is some progress. There are some quantities concerning these Wilson loops that we can compute at all values of the coupling, but there is not yet a complete final solution at any value of the coupling. You can ask, for example, Tian Heng more about some quantities that we can compute at all loops using exactly this integrability. But the hope is that there will be some sort of thermodynamic Bittenzatz kind of equations that will describe these polygons at all loops. And it was exactly some sort of thermodynamic Bittenzatz equations that gave the quark anti-quark potential at all loop order very recently. So, okay, I think this more or less summarizes some of the most exciting recent developments on Wilson loops. Of course, I am not expecting at all that you grasp everything that I said in this last 10 minutes. This is just for you to get an overview of where the field is. And tomorrow, we will move to local observables. In particular, tomorrow, we will start studying correlation functions of 2 and 3 points. And I encourage you to revise, since no one checks the wiki, to revise what you learned in conformal field theory about 2 and 3 point functions, and also to study again the tutorial on the geometry of antidecida. Okay? Questions?
You said that you're gonna explain about these two loops, why did it cancel?
Why did they cancel?
Yeah.
No, they cancel because you see that from the point of view of localization, you arrive directly at a matrix model. So a matrix model, by definition, doesn't contain, a Gaussian matrix model, by definition, doesn't contain vertices. So if you understand why it localizes, you understand why this long computation that they did had to be zero. The challenge is, of course, to understand why this complicated path integral became only an integral over the constant mode of one of the scalars. Okay? That you can ask Satoshi.
But isn't it possible to see it by supersymmetry?
Yes, it's very much related to supersymmetry, but it's not something that I would be able to reproduce right now. It's not a straightforward computation. It's actually a very interesting paper, this patent paper. It's quite a piece of work. More? Is there something that I left out that you would like me to still explore a bit more concerning non-local observables before moving to local observables, or are you okay?
Are there more?
There are surface operators, for example, operators that don't depend on a line but depend on a surface. Wilson loops are what happens when you study propagation of a charged particle with respect to electric charge. But what about magnetic particles, monopole? Mm-hmm. Then you have toothed loops, very interesting objects that Jaume is a big specialist on. So there are other objects, not only with one dimension, but then higher dimensions and so on. There are domain walls and so on. More? No? Very good. Was it fast? A bit?